I have a holiday related theme. And how many people are preparing to have some kind of gathering with family or friends or communities around the holidays? Okay, so the talk tonight is on practicing with views, opinions, beliefs, and positions at the time of the holidays, we could say. So I'll focus on how we work with our various kinds of views or beliefs or positions, spiritual, political, some of them quite personal. How do we do that? And so I'm going to have a very simple structure. I'm going to talk about first the way that the Buddha understands how we relate to what he calls views, or what is translated as views. The word in the Pali is ditti, D-I-I-T-H-I. Usually translated as views, I think could be translated as beliefs or maybe positions and so forth, philosophies perhaps. And so first part, I want to talk about how the Buddha looks at views. And then the second part of the talk, I want to talk about ways that we can practice, perhaps in gatherings with hopefully loved ones and people we're close to. So I'm being a little bit humorous, but obviously it's a very crucial topic, that how we relate to our views, our opinions, our beliefs, how we even are conscious of what they are, whether we're conscious of what they are, is a very crucial dimension of our practice. You know, and there's this whole range of what we can call views, ranging all the way from political views, philosophical views, metaphysical views, spiritual views, to views that are more about ourselves, a lot of which are relatively unconscious or half conscious. We may have views that were embedded when we were children. We may have views about ourselves. I'm good. I'm not so good. This part of me is not okay. And unless we work with them, those kind of views stay with us our whole lives. A lot of those can be negative at times. Can sometimes call them limiting beliefs, is the language I use. I'll come back to that. And we can also have views that, again, are relatively unconscious, sometimes related to social conditioning. Views that in recent times have been identified with the term implicit bias. You know, biases that are there in large part through social conditioning, might be there in relation to gender or race or age or all the different social hierarchies which are there in our society. And we can also ask how we get to know them, how we practice. Some of our views are well known. Some of them are relatively unconscious, and they can still dominate us. It can be somewhat scary to contemplate that. You know, in terms of the holidays, how can we really relate openly to people who may have different views? How can we talk about what's important to us, sometimes bringing out views in a way that connects with people rather than is divisive? And we know that in the U.S. society, as in much of the world, so many of the views that people have are a basis for division, polarization, even violence, right? And so if anyone has a good connection with the U.S. Congress, and if they'd be interested in a training on working with views, let me know. You can raise your hand if you have that kind of good connection. Okay. Oh, got a few. So yeah. So thank you. And we can do that. Yeah, I was thinking of, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. once said that many people, and he was talking a lot about what was there in the, southern part of the United States, in the 50s and 60s, he said that people live in monologue rather than dialogue. So the deeper question will be, how can we have a genuine dialogue, empathic connection? How can we work with the dangers that are very evident of attachment to views? And this was also the central concern the Buddha had. And as many of you know, the Buddha himself was very critical of those who would be attached to views, including views related to his own teachings. They're fairly remarkable in the history of what we call religions to have that perspective. And so the Buddha very commonly talked about views being both skillful and unskillful at times, but even the skillful ones, not helpful to be attached to them. Even the views coming from his own teachings. And so the Buddha talked about views at best being helpful for awakening, but being ultimately practical, not something to be attached to, not something to be taken as ultimately true. In fact, being attached to views is an impediment to awakening. And it seems to come with the territory. It's something that all of us probably at times find ourselves involved in. Attachment to views or attachment to practices. And interestingly, he also said that at the level of views, there are no ultimate truths. And he was critical of the main spiritual or metaphysical views of his time and counseled practitioners to stay away from views. So I want to work with four particular teachings on views from the Buddha and then talk about ways of practicing. And so I'll go to the screen share and I want to put this on the screen, some passages. Okay. Okay, can you see this now? Bill and Barbara, is this okay? Working okay? And can you see the whole page? Just the first part, huh?
Okay. We can see the whole width of it, Donald.
The whole width, and we're, because on my screen, I see the whole thing. So where do you say it? Where does it end?
We don't. It ends, it has the first paragraph of the first two lines of the second paragraph.
Oh, okay. Okay, I'll have to find a way to make this work.
And I can't see the whole paragraph, the whole width.
Okay, I'm not sure what's happening. So I think I
won't see the whole width either. I'm with you.
I think I won't use this then. Okay, so we'll forget this. Because it's a little bit too confusing to try to do the technical part and give the talk at the same time. So I think I'll let that go. But I'll read the passages. So the first passage, I'll read four passages. The first passage is the well-known text about the poisoned arrow. Probably many of you know this. I'll read it to you. It's as if a person were wounded with an arrow thickly smeared with poison. So this is going to be a teaching that's basically saying, don't get attached to views. The essence is practical dimension. It's just as if a person were wounded with an arrow thickly smeared with poison. Friends and companions, kinspeople and relatives would provide the person with a surgeon. And the person would say, I won't have this arrow removed until I know whether the one who wounded me was a noble warrior, a Brahmin, a merchant, or a worker. Those are the four castes in India of that time. The person would say, I won't have this arrow removed until I know the given name and clan name of the one who wounded me, until I know whether the person was tall, medium, or short, until I know whether the person was dark, ruddy brown, or golden colored, until I know the home village, town, or city, until I know whether the bow with which I was wounded was a longbow or a crossbow. That person would die, and those things would still remain unknown. So all of that information and any views that develop on the basis of that are irrelevant to the practical aim of practice. We could say that that's what is being taught by this first teaching, that you don't need a lot of information. You need the essence to help with awakening. The second teaching is a well-known teaching. The Buddha is talking with a wandering yogi named Vachagota. And he's asked by Vachagota whether there is a self. The Buddha does not answer. Then the Buddha is asked whether there is no self. The Buddha does not answer. The Buddha later said that to emphasize either self or no self would confuse the person. So this is interesting because the Buddha could have said, hey, don't you know I sometimes teach about anatta? Yeah, where have you been? Right? But he actually, in this context, he refused to go to a more metaphysical view about the self or not self. And that's interesting because I think what he said here is actually probably a more adequate way of dealing with this issue than the teaching about not self. I think it's actually pointing to the way that one can't really use this metaphysical concept of the self and get to a clear answer. At best, it's a practical teaching. The third teaching, it's a well-known teaching about seeing all of the Dharma as like a raft. Imagine, friends, someone in the course of a journey arrives at a great expanse of water whose near bank is dangerous and whose far bank offers safety. But there is no ferry boat or bridge to take him across the water. So this one thinks, what if I collected grass, twigs, branches, and leaves and bound them together as a raft? supported by the raft and paddling with my hands and feet, I should then be able to reach the far bank. That happens, and this person reaches the far bank. On reaching the far bank, it might occur to this person, this raft has been very helpful indeed. What if I were to hoist it on my head or shoulders and then proceed on my journey? What do you think? By carrying it with them, would that person be doing what should be done with a raft? The people the Buddha's talking to say no. So what should this person do with the raft? Having arrived at the far bank, the person might think, yes, this raft has been very useful, but now I should just haul it onto dry land or maybe leave it floating in the water and then continue on my journey. In this way, the person would be doing what should be done with the raft. And then the Buddha concludes, the Dharma, too, is like a raft and serves the purpose of crossing over, not the purpose of grasping. How's that for the teaching? The Dharma is like a raft. It serves the purpose of crossing over, not the purpose of grasping. Again, I find this unusual in the history of religions to say the teachings and practices are useful tools. Watch out for grasping after them. Watch out for having even some ultimate belief in them. Very, very, very interesting. And then the last text is also well known, also making the point that the teachings are practical. This is where the Buddha comes to the village or the town of the Kalamas, which is like a crossroads. A lot of different spiritual teachers come. And they get a lot of teachers who badmouth each other and claim that they're giving the truth, the true practices, and so forth. You know, it's like a place, a little bit like the Bay Area, where you can come and every weekend you can do a seminar, right? And you'll have all this choice of all these teachings. And so they come to the Buddha and say, we're really confused by all these different views. This teacher says we have the best perspective, the best teachings, the best practices. What do we do? And here's the last of the readings. It is proper for you, Kalamas, to doubt, to be uncertain. Come, Kalamas, listen to me. Do not go upon what has been advanced by repeated hearing, nor upon tradition. In other words, Buddha saying, don't believe it just because it's tradition, nor upon rumor, nor upon what is in a scripture. Don't believe it just because it's in a scripture, nor upon surmise, nor upon an axiom, nor upon reasoning, nor upon a bias towards a notion that has been pondered over, nor upon the consideration, this person is our teacher. Interesting, right? Don't even believe it because you think this person is our teacher. But rather, when you yourselves know these things are bad, these things are blamable, these things are censured by the wise, undertaken and observed, these things lead to harm, abandon them. When you yourselves know these things are good, these things are approved by the wise, undertaken and observed, these things lead to good things, to awakening, then follow them. Very interesting, isn't it? You know, that, again, check it out. But he is saying that it's not just on each of us. This is where community is important, teachers are important. He's saying, when you know that this is what the wise counsel, he's including that as part of his answer. So it's not simply work it out for yourself. I would say it's work it out in community, maybe working with teachers, with the wise, and that's all part of it. But it's a practical answer. So we could say that what can be problematic about views is that we get attached to them. They're connected with reactivity. We grasp after them, we push them away. Again, whether they're spiritual views or personal views, you know, that we tend to grasp onto views, even views which have some truth or some half-truth. You know, I was thinking about this because I've been doing a training on eco-dharma, on connection of looking at ecological issues and core teachings. And one of the things we've looked at, which has been very interesting, is how many ecological activists may have half-truths. You know, they don't really see clearly the whole picture, but they have half-truths, and then they kind of grasp onto the half-truth, and we might say overgeneralize. This is something we often do. You know, so there are views like people who are very concerned about, you know, the way that there hasn't been really an adequate response in the last decades, and they come up with a view, it's too late, right? Which leads to a lot of negative consequences. It's kind of a half-truth because it's based on an insight into things being in a difficult place. Or maybe saying people don't care about climate change. You know, clearly many don't, but many, many do. Or people don't have the right information. Many don't, but some do. But people who get fixated on these views, that's just to give some very concrete examples, may do things which are not helpful from a practical perspective. You know, and again, one of the tricky things is that many of the views we have are relatively unconscious. You know, I've talked here when I talk on transforming the judgmental mind on how many of our most common judgments are rooted in what we can call limiting beliefs that often are inculcated when we're young. You know, it could be, you know, one that I've worked with several people. An example I've given sometimes is people who as children have parents who divorce. Many of those children develop a limiting belief, if someone gets close to me, that person will leave. And it goes into the unconscious, but it's a view. So this is more to point to the complications of working with views, that it also involves going into what's not so conscious or semi-conscious. A lot of views are developed in childhood. Sometimes views come if we've had any trauma or difficult experiences. And how do we work with those? So it's really a deep area. So three practices for working with views. The first is bring mindfulness to all the different views that you have, whether positive or negative, whether skillful or not so skillful. Study them, you know, could be for the next week. Look at the views that turn up in your experience, the views, the opinions, the beliefs, you know, take breaks at your holiday gatherings, right? Take some notes. What have been the main views that I've expressed in the last half hour, right? Take notes. You know, at the end of a holiday gathering, say, what are my top 5 views or what are my top 10 views? So one dimension of working with views is just to identify with mindfulness what they are. Another one is to, especially once that's happened, to then look at what the experience is like when the view is very strong. You know, again, could be a political view, a spiritual view, one of these limiting beliefs. When they're present, what's my experience? What's it like in the body? What's the storyline? What's the emotional energy? You know, some of the people I work with on the judgmental mind really have to track when they have repetitive narratives that they go into, for example, when something difficult happens. Could be a self-blame when I've had a hard experience. You know, I was just talking earlier today with people who were meeting with me a week after we finished a retreat. And one person talked about being really getting hard on himself because he didn't sustain the practice like he wanted to, and he found himself getting into all sorts of habits, old habits that he thought he could go beyond. And the judgments just came, the narratives came. And, you know, after a while, those kind of narratives are hardly conscious. So the first practice is really tracking and studying the views that are there. A second practice is an interesting one. It's one that I learned several decades ago, which I use a lot, which is noticing when there is a charge around someone else's view and start letting that be the starting point for inquiry. You know, this happened, I mentioned a while ago, I was, a long time ago, I was teaching philosophy, which I did for 7 years at universities and colleges. And I was invited to be part of a really interesting project, which brought me out to California. It was connected with Esalen. We had a project called the Revisioning Philosophy Project, which is wanting to bring philosophy back to its roots in wisdom and back to its practical roots. And, you know, its connection with the issues of our time, rather than having it be abstract and esoteric, you know, and overly academic. And so we had a great group of people, wonderful people, people you may know, like Jacob Needleman and Houston Smith. Some wonderful people were part of the group. I was probably one of the youngest, if not the youngest, at that time. So, you know, it was a while ago. Interestingly, even though this was supposedly an awakened group, guess what? We started noticing attachment to views and a certain argumentativeness around views. And near the beginning of this arising, one of my colleagues, some of you may know, Robert McDermott, who later became president of CIIS. And Robert said, let's take the situation when I notice a charge, when you've expressed a view that I disagree with, and I notice a charge inside, let it be a starting point for inquiry. Let me go inside and experience what I'm experiencing, and then ask questions like, why do I have such a reaction to this view? Let that be an inquiry question. Is there something in my background which makes me not want to be with this view? And to really stay with that and do that in the daily flow is a second practice. And then the last practice is similar. It's when someone has a view that we find difficult, problematic, wrong, dumb, stupid, etc. Let it be a starting point for empathy and understanding and listening. Let me try to be with that person and understand, why is this important for this person? What's their interview? We could really bring what I'm calling a third practice and connect it with the second. But can I really listen to this other person's view? Try to see why it's important, and bring empathy, which, you know, some of you know, an empathy practice I like to offer is be with the emotions of the other person in the sense of what matters. And so, powerful practice. You know, one could make the case that a polarized society like the United States, perhaps the most important capacity for the whole society is empathy. I remember, yeah, I mentioned it from time to time. I remember there was a San Francisco Chronicle columnist. Some of you may remember a name, Otis Taylor, who I think left the area and went to Atlanta maybe 2 years ago. At the time of the 2016 election, I think it was October 2016, he said, what this country most needs is empathy. It's not, you know, what's important is not, you know, leaked emails. It's not this or that. It's actually empathy, what we most need. And so, you know, that can be a very powerful practice, not just with views, but anytime there's a difference. So try these at your holiday gatherings. Have a strong intention for empathy at your holiday gathering. Anyone up for it? Okay. The hand, when you raise your hand, it reflects absolute commitment. Okay. So we all saw it. So there you go. So let me stop there. You know, I've given some of the core teachings from the Buddha about the practical essence of views, positions, and so forth. And then these three practices that can help us explore more. So let's sit quietly just for, you know, a minute or so and see what's there for you. Maybe there's a question or something to share. Let's have quiet for about a minute. So please, I'm open to any sharing, any question, any situation that you might want to apply it to. Deborah, please.
I raise my hand.
I don't know how to do what Patty is doing there with the yellow hand. So okay. Thank you. This is so beautiful, Donald. Thank you. I was talking earlier today with a cousin back east. Who is very unwell, mentally, emotionally, physically, very unwell, and who expresses a lot of views that are not in alignment with my views. And I noticed that I had all the patience in the world for him. Mm. I had total understanding, having come out of the same family background and having had advantages he hasn't had. And I was quite pleased at how untriggered I was. Maybe you can comment on why I can be that way with him and not with others, especially people I listen to and maybe ought not to on television.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, Deborah. And how many can relate to that question? Something in your own experience that's similar to that. Yeah. Deborah, can I turn it back to you and ask you, what's your sense?
Well, I think he's not in a position of power, so he can't enact anything. He's not in the legislature. I think he's my cousin. I grew up with him, and I understand what he went through. I know what his life has been like. So I think those two things have... I think those two things, but I was just wondering, you know, I mean, it's up to me, right, to develop my practice so that I can bring that to others.
Mm-hmm. But the principle, if, you know, if I would answer that, I would point to the priority of the relationship. I also heard understanding and compassion. You know, those three things, I had to name them, interrelated things. And you could generalize from that and say, you know, if I had those three things in a, you know, in being with another person, I would probably not be attached to my views and critical. And so we can work to develop those things. I mean, my talking about empathy was related to that. Yeah.
I've had a lot of training in the past in NVC, so I get the whole empathy thing. And I know it's totally up to me to develop my heart capacities and my detachment to be more kindly to someone who isn't my cousin.
Yeah, why don't you try it out with someone who's not too difficult first? You know, just remember that degree of difficulty map. Try it with someone who's a 5 or a 6. Don't go right to the 9 or 10.
Thank you, Donald. Deborah. Thank you.
Patty, and then Bowman and Cherie, and then Alice, yeah.
Thank you, Donald. This is really great. I agree that empathy is probably what's missing the most of everything that's missing in our culture. But when you talk about mindfulness, I understand feeling in the body, but the word that keeps coming up for me about my own views is humility.
Yeah.
I keep trying to realize I may be wrong. I feel very strongly that I'm right, but I may be wrong. I don't have the whole perspective. I'm not looking at it from like a godlike view. So if I can remember the phrase, I may be wrong, and if I can remember to be humble, it's easier for me to listen to other people's views, because whether they know it or not, they may be wrong too. So I feel like we're in the same boat. We both are not quite 100% sure that we're right, even if we feel like we're 100% sure we're right.
Right. Beautiful, Patty. It really brings in an aspect that I didn't bring out so much, which is, you know, it follows from that sense that one can't have 100% correct view. You know, one of my teachers once said, all theories leak. Mm-hmm. There was another author who said once, let's see, something like, no theory is correct. Some are useful.
That's good.
Right. And so having that perspective and humility and being open to, you know, look at what we sometimes call evidence or facts or reasons. And really, it's really coming from a place, starting point of non-attachment, you know, which, you know, we could say is the essence of good science is something like that. Right. You know, science in the good sense, or of knowledge generally. So having that humility, that sounds really, really helpful to add to our discussion.
Thank you.
And seeing where there's not humility, you know, or seeing which of my views am I, you know, am I kind of open about might be wrong, and which of my views, you know, I'm right, no doubt.
But see, I've learned to get along with people, even if I believe I'm right, no doubt. I've learned not to share that with people, but to always say, I may be wrong, but this is how I feel. Because by saying,
I may be wrong, even if you think you're not.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
It's helpful in communication to admit that you may be wrong.
And to really believe it. Yeah.
Well, it helps to believe it by saying it over and over again, even though I don't believe it the first time I say it.
That's right. That's right.
Are you talking to me?
No. Yeah.
Thanks. Bowman and Cherie, please.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I was thinking about, Donald, when we did the transforming the judgmental mind. And you talked about challenging the view.
Yeah.
So since then, that is the thing that usually comes up for me. You know, I feel it in my body and all that. I usually can't figure out definitively where it came from, but I do find it helpful just to kind of say, to challenge the view and say, well, what if I saw it like the other person does?
Yeah.
Even if I don't.
It's beautiful. It's really it's really taking these teachings and having practical ways of implementation that help us move away from inflexibility, attachment, whatever we call it, right? And like, just like Patty was saying, I might be wrong. And, you know, you could say that, you know, Patty probably sometimes says, I might be wrong. And then internally she says, no, I'm right. Right. And so, but having those ways of just, noticing attachment and questioning it and just remembering the teachings. And again, I think the Buddha is saying that a view can, like I was saying, giving different versions, there's no view which can be 100% correct.
Yeah, I try not to get hooked up on who's right and who's wrong.
Yeah.
Because, of course, I'm always going to think I'm right, right? So just it's just a matter of kind of wondering, why does that other person have that view? And what would it be like if I did have that view? Not necessarily judging it as right or wrong, just kind of how would the situation change if I had a different view?
Right, and really prioritizing connection, empathy, maybe, a shared inquiry, beautiful, and, not always possible. I can have an open attitude, or one of us could have an open attitude, maybe the other person doesn't. So nothing guaranteed. And one of the hardest situations is to be open when other people don't seem open, right? That's a hard one. Yeah. Thanks, Sheree.
Thanks, Donald.
Yeah. And Alice, please.
Okay. I have somebody that I see pretty often, and just recently she was sharing something that brought up a lot of views of mine. She was sharing, and I was just acting as a sounding board, because she was sharing some things like, that were like thousands of arrows that she was shooting at herself, and it involved revenge and old stories, and she was going to do things that I have a view were really unskillful. But I was only acting as a sounding board. And I was thinking, that's not enough, because what she wanted was agreement, but I couldn't give her agreement, because I thought, this is the place I wouldn't want to be going. Yeah. And so I don't know if I should say, would you like to know what I would offer if you wanted my advice? I don't know exactly. I mean, that might sound really condescending.
Yeah. I think some... if she's very explicit that she wants agreement, but it sounds like that was more implicit, that she wants agreement. And I think some version of your question would be skillful, where it was said with, and then the ability to really tune in empathically and compassionately, but to have some version of your question, like, I have some thoughts about that. Would you be interested? Or some version of that, really tunes into how she is. And she may say no. I know I sometimes ask people that in certain circumstances, and they say no, not now, or something like that, for different reasons, right? So I think, and offer it, really with a sincere attitude that you're fine if she says no. You want to look at that too, because right, because you might say it with a tone that suggests that if she doesn't say yes, there's a problem.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
We want to look at that. Yeah. Thanks. Great question, Al. These are wonderful questions. We're preparing for the holidays. Yay. Okay. Barbara and Bill, please.
I found. By the way, I do your morning meditation about non-attachment, renouncing attachment to views every morning.
Wow.
But I found that the whole idea of empathy, if I can understand what are my values and what's the other person's basic values,
right.
Do we have a value in common? Oh, I can understand you want to be safe, or you want to have a loving community. And somehow, if you could get to that point, it's not always possible to perceive it, but I think sometimes, especially if I pause and remember my vow to renounce attachment to my view, then I could begin to see, oh, we have this value in common.
That's right.
And then it's no longer this clash.
Right. That can be so huge, and that's a very skillful strategy when they're radically different views. And I probably have told this story occasionally here, but it really stayed with me that some time ago, I was part of an interfaith retreat of sorts, sort of a social action retreat at Los Alamos National Laboratory. And we had 5 days there. And they said, yeah, you can be here. You just can't use our bathrooms. So we spent 5 days there without using their bathrooms. The way we dealt with that was that we rented like an RV that had a bathroom. And we brought that, and we actually did meditation in the parking lot of Los Alamos National Laboratory with an interfaith retreat. Not large, about 30 people. We had, a lot of people came up to us. Some of them left flowers. During lunch, we ate with the technicians and the scientists in the main cafeteria. And we had about 30 people. We just had, one or two of us would join a group and just sit down. And we talked. And very commonly, at least in the discussions I was part of, people would talk about why building nuclear weapons was a good thing, right? And we would be in discussions. And we stayed at a campground. And in the evenings, we would sort of debrief how the day had been. And my experience was, some of the people in our group got into really arguments about views at that time. And I know I was trying just to listen, very much like, I think like Barbara was saying, I would listen for the value. And they would, people would, near the beginning of the discussion, talk about why nuclear weapons are important. Very commonly they would talk about security, right? I can agree that security is important, right? And could really have some connection with them, even if I thought there are better strategies to find security and so forth. And, other than would give other reasons, but there was like, could I really tune in and see how this makes sense for someone with very different views? And it was interesting, again, in our group, some people did that. Some people got into clashes, and we talked about that together. And so how can we go into that sort of situation, very different views, with, with empathy and really wanting to understand? So maybe I think I'll offer that as a practice for the holiday time. Again, how many of you will bring some of this, want to bring at least some of this to holiday gatherings? I'll raise my hand also. Okay, very good. Okay, and I wish we could come back. I don't come back again until February, but maybe we can compare notes then.